We're going to start the meeting, and we have about 3 days' worth of people signed up to talk, so I would hope that they would keep it to 5 minutes or less. And we're going to start with, Karen Sams from the Occupational Therapy Association. Is she here? And did I pronounce that right?
Sames.
Sames, okay.
Representative Huntley and members of the Healthcare and Human Services Finance Division, thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. My name is Karen Sames. I'm a volunteer with MOTA, and for my paying job, I'm an associate professor of occupational science and occupational therapy at St. Catherine University. Occupational therapy enables people to do the day-to-day activities that are important to them despite impairments, activity limitations, participation restrictions, or despite risks for these problems. Occupations are another name for these day-to-day activities. Occupational therapy helps people function in their daily lives related to home, school, community, and the workplace. MOTA urges you to reject the governor's supplemental budget proposal that calls for the elimination of rehabilitation services for non-pregnant adults enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs. You've probably heard this proposal called penny-wise and pound-foolish or dollar-foolish 1,000 times. I would suggest this proposal is not penny-wise. It's actually penny-foolish because it would result in an immediate increase in cost to the state. It won't take long for people to show up in emergency rooms because they've injured themselves trying to prepare a meal, dress themselves, bathe without any of the adaptive equipment or assistive technology that occupational therapists provide. It won't take long for people with persistent mental illness to show up in emergency rooms because their ability to cope with life situations is diminished without the interventions provided by occupational therapy. It won't take long for people who are newly diagnosed with strokes, brain tumors, hip fractures, and the like to be moved to long-term care facilities because they did not receive the outpatient or home-based rehabilitation services and they lack the tools and skills necessary to take care of themselves. Imagine two brothers driving home from a Twins game, but their car is hit by a drunk driver. Neither brother is wearing a seatbelt. They're 19 and 21 years old. Under the governor's proposal, both would receive acute care and therapies. However, only the 19-year-old would be able to get outpatient therapy to make progress towards self-sufficiency, have splints adjusted, and obtain assisted technologies to enable independence. The 21-year-old brother would not receive any of these services. Every healthcare professional knows that quality rehabilitation services offer a great return on investment. Money spent helping people recover from disabling injuries and illnesses or preventing further disabilities saves future dollars in both acute and long-term care. The proposed elimination of rehabilitation services, including occupational therapy, will cost more money than it saves. It's a very bad return on investment. And we have studies to prove it. A randomized clinical trial conducted in 2002 by researchers at the University of Southern California found that a 9-month course of occupational therapy for older adults living in their own homes resulted in lower post-treatment costs. The cost for the 9 months of occupational therapy, which was rendered once a month visits, was $548. The post-intervention medical expenses measured for the following 6 months at the end of the 9-month intervention. For people in the OT program, cost $967, which was far less than the active control group, which was $1,726, and the passive control group, which was over $3,000. Those in the experimental group, the ones that received occupational therapy, actually saved the state of California, on average, $2,400 per person in that 6-month period. Another randomized clinical trial was conducted by Dutch researchers, and they showed that adding occupational therapy to treatment as usual for people with severe depression, and treatment as usual was defined as monthly outpatient psychiatric visits, resulted in fewer lost days of work. so that people were more productive. When adults on Minnesota healthcare programs suffer disabling injuries or illnesses and are denied access to therapy, they lose their ability or might lose their ability to work, to take care of themselves, to make themselves less financially dependent on the state. Occupational therapy is cost-effective. We urge you to retain rehabilitation services, including occupational therapy, for persons on Minnesota healthcare programs as you negotiate the budget. We understand the economic difficulties that the state faces. We don't understand why rehabilitation services were singled out among all the possible optional services under Minnesota healthcare programs for this elimination. We are actively working with representatives of the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association and the Minnesota Speech and Hearing Association to try and identify alternatives to eliminating rehab services and help close the budget gap. We look forward to working with you to ensure that these essential services are available to people who need it. Thank you.
Questions? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony, and at least as far as I'm concerned, you're preaching to the converted.
Thanks. Do you need me to sign in?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Yeah, Jonathan Watson.
He's not going to be here.
Oh, Sarah Cruz. Sarah Cruz and from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. And next would be, after that, is Kathy Knight from Fairview Hospitals and Clinics.
Can I begin?
So, Ms. Cruz.
Good morning, Mr.
State your name for the tape.
Yes, I will. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Cruz, and I am the Executive Director for Open Door Health Center in Mankato, Minnesota. I'm here today to testify on three items in the governor's supplemental budget proposal. To give you some perspective first, Open Doors served 2,050 patients in 2009, and we've been steadily growing this year. Patients predominantly come from 10 counties in south central Minnesota. Roughly 42% of our patients are uninsured, and if I look at just the medical patients, about 70% of our medical patients are uninsured. An additional 48% of our medical patients are enrolled in Medical Assistance Minnesota Care, GAMC. Clearly, Open Door and the other 15 community health centers throughout the state are a valuable primary care access point for low-income Minnesotans. First, I am opposed to the governor's proposal to reduce funding by $1 million to federally qualified health centers in Minnesota. At Open Door, we use our subsidy money to support patient care services. In 2009, we were able to see over 1,000 new patients. When we surveyed these new patients, 38% of them said that they would not have seen another provider. They would not have gotten care if Open Door did not exist. And 13% said they would have gone to an emergency room for that care. Part of the reason Open Door is still operating today is because of the state's past financial support. Reducing these funds would likely reduce our capacity to provide care at a time when it is so needed and needs are increasing. As a side note, the governor's budget justifies this cut by assuming that the community health centers in the state receive $4.8 million from the federal stimulus package. That number is slightly incorrect. It should be $3.6 million, but a key point is that those funds from the stimulus money only cover a small portion of fiscal year 2011. The fact remains that collectively, community health centers provide roughly $33 million in care to the uninsured, of which $18 million is covered by the federal government, including the one-time stimulus. The $2.5 million provided by the state greatly helps us to maintain our commitment to serving one out of every six uninsured Minnesotans. The second piece of the governor's budget that I'm opposed to is reducing Minnesota care eligibility for single adults without children to 75% of poverty. With 42% of Open Doors patients already uninsured, we have no ability to cost shift the uncompensated care losses. Consequently, we aggressively enroll some of our uninsured into public programs like Minnesota Care. Scaling back eligibility for Minnesota Care will simply translate into additional uninsured for community health centers. This is the result of current patients who would lose coverage combined with other newly uninsured for other reasons that are seeking out care at community health centers. The downturn in the economy has shown us how far the uninsured will travel to get these services for primary care. Statewide, there are 16 community health centers, and we serve over 50% of the state zip codes. Open Door is the only FQHC in the southern part of the state, and patients often travel over an hour to get care. Last year, Open Door served at least 10 people from 24 different zip codes, and when we took a look at all the zip code spread, we had at least one person that had come to us from 109 different zip codes in the state. There's a chart on the handout that was distributed to you on the second page that breaks this apart in terms of percentages by counties, so you'll see the predominant counties that Open Door serves. Finally, we remain opposed to the governor's plan to transition GAMC enrollees into the Minnesota Care Program. The affordability of the Minnesota Care premiums are chief among the reason we feel that proposal may not work. In my opinion, the governor's budget dramatically creates more uninsured Minnesotans. On top of that, the proposal also reduces resources from organizations like Open Door that are needed to serve these uninsured in the most cost-effective settings. Thank you very much for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions for Ms. Cruz? I don't see any. We passed something for your particular center a year ago or 2 years ago.
You did.
What was that?
You passed a special subsidy type of grant. We called it bridge funding. Open Door had been a federally qualified health center lookalike for a number of years, but as a lookalike, you don't receive any federal grant money. And we were really struggling with, you see the proportions, and actually this is even a smaller proportion of uninsured than what Open Door historically has served in our medical program, and we were really struggling to keep our medical services alive. And you granted us $350,000, and then we became a funded FQHC as part of the stimulus money in March. And the state is the reason that Open Door is still here today. So for that, on behalf of my organization, I'm very grateful.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And
thank
next
you.
Is Kathy Knight from Fairview. And Ann Henry will be up after that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I think you've been here before, haven't you?
I think I have. good afternoon, Representative Huntley and committee members. My name is Kathy Knight, and I'm a mental health nurse of 34 years combined military service and Fairview service. And I'm currently the vice president at the University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview, and I lead Behavioral Health Division. Thank you for the opportunity to share my perspective on Governor Pawlenty's budget proposal. I am speaking today on behalf of all Fairview hospitals and clinics when I tell you that I am deeply concerned about the proposal and what it would mean for our patients, our ability to provide patient care, and our ability to educate future medical professionals. The governor's budget proposal will cost Fairview Health Services $22 million in 2010 and more than $77 million over 3 years. I want to make three key points. The first is that cuts to medical assistance provider payment rates will erode care delivery. The proposals call for an additional 3% rate reduction to inpatient MA rates. That's an $11.2 million impact to Fairview over 3 years. And it would be the fifth round of payment cuts in the last 10 years. Today, we are paid far less than it costs to deliver care. More cuts would further exacerbate that problem and put pressure on businesses and commercial insurers through cost shifting. And it is programs that already operate at a loss, like behavioral health services at the university, that are put at greater risk of reduced staffing hours, layoffs, and program closures with continued payment rate cuts. The second point is the cutting of MRC funding is a short-sighted decision with significant long-term consequences. UMMC is the largest teaching hospital in the state. Each year we have 340 residents, doctors in training. These are students that come from across the country and the world for the opportunity to train at our hospital and the University of Minnesota. Many of them stay in Minnesota and form the basis of our outstanding physician community. Fairview System also provides clinical, hands-on education to pharmacy students, nursing students, and many more. The loss of MRC funding to be $7.9 million in 2010 alone would require us to make very difficult decisions about the size and sustainability of our residency programs and other clinical education programs. Let me be clear. Merck cuts threaten the pipeline of future physicians and other medical professionals across the state. Psychiatry is one specialty where we can ill afford further shortages. 38 Minnesota counties today have no psychiatry. Often it is not the bed that is unavailable, but the physician. We are graduating 8 psychiatrists this year that we hope will practice in Minnesota. And my last point is that health care and the low-income patients that we serve should not shoulder the burden of balancing the budget. While Health and Human Services is a large segment of the state budget, during difficult financial times, everyone should share in the effort and pain of balancing the budget. Yet the governor's proposal disproportionately cuts health care spending for low-income, vulnerable, and often acutely ill individuals, and leaves other, even bigger portions of the budget untouched. We are asking for a more equitable approach to solve this difficult budget situation. Fairview and behavioral health care, in particular, cannot absorb cuts from GAMC and these other directions as well. Thank you for your time today.
Questions? I don't see. So thank you for your testimony. And next we have Ann Henry from the Disability Law Center.
Thank you.
And Michelle Kimball is next.
I do have copies. I hate to give you more paper, but if there is somebody to pass them out. My name is Ann Henry. I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society, and we represent low-income children and adults with complex lifelong disabilities throughout Minnesota. In the brief time we have today, I'd like to just make four overview points and then just mention a couple of the items on the list that you will see in the handout. But first of all, thank you very much for holding these hearings. I think they're extremely important. The first overall point is that when I began looking at the budget to try to figure out what to talk to you about, it became very clear that I could likely copy all the items and hand them back to you because so many of these affect people with disabilities directly and indirectly. And let me just focus a bit on the indirectly. It is extremely important for people with disabilities who need disability services that we prevent people from becoming disabled who have chronic conditions. And the governor's budget does the opposite. By eliminating GAMC, cutting Minnesota Care for working adults without children down to 75% of poverty, cutting critical access dental, eliminating cash general assistance, and the numerous cuts to mental health services. This is really the wrong direction, and it's quite frightening in terms of what we need to do to prevent people from descending and needing higher-end services. The second point is, I think it's important to recall, and you've heard this and you'll hear it again from other people, disability services, along with a lot of health and human services, have had repeated cuts, disproportionate cuts, going back to 2002. And the cumulative effect of those repeated cuts are very, very serious to people with disabilities, their families, and certainly to the providers of those services. Added cuts on top of what we're already experiencing are going to be quite harsh. I'm sure a lot of you are aware that the cuts to the Personal Care Assistant Program are just rolling out across the state. They're going to continue for a year and a half, culminating in about estimated 1,600 people being totally eliminated by July of 2011. So this is really concerning to look at what else is going to happen to those groups. Third, I want to thank you and encourage you to continue the questions you're asking about the consequences of the budget cuts. What are the other costs? My clients with disabilities needs are not going to go away because, for instance, rehabilitative OT, PT, speech is cut. These needs are going to come out somewhere else. We foresee increased hours of PCA service, people staying longer in the hospital to get the rehab they need to function maximally. So the budget, we think, is really irresponsible in not reflecting an understanding of what's been called human hydraulics. When you push down air or water or on, I think, low-income people, it's going to come out somewhere. We are going to have catastrophes, personal emergencies, and unfortunately slow erosion, which won't be clear for a while, but is going to cost us a lot in the long run to remedy. And the fourth point is that we well understand the grim fiscal future, and that's why we strongly support tax increase as part of the solution. We understand there are going to be spending cuts, but we also urge reform and administrative simplification. And I'll just give you two quick examples. Consolidation of the management of disability services from the 87 units that we have at the counties to a smaller number is long overdue. And we think we could do better if we would do that. Another idea that has been that was in legislation last session from Representative Loeffler is establishing a revolving public equity housing fund. We invest a lot of state and federal money in housing for people with disabilities, and when that property is sold, we ought to retain the public equity share into a revolving fund and reuse it. A report on that is due back to you in December. Let me just mention a couple of the specific items, and then I'll finish. The MFIP SSI proposal certainly has to be one of the cruelest cuts on these pages. These families are already living below poverty with children, and they are affected by disability. A family of five is likely to lose half of their below poverty income. You will hear more about this from my colleagues later. The other point I want to make, you've already heard the rehabilitative therapies. That is a perfect example to notice human hydraulics at work, because we will see other costs in other places if that is to be implemented. And the last one I'll just mention from my list in the handout is the governor asks you to ratify the 275-hour PCA staff work limit, and we are very concerned about that. Since the legislature implemented a 310-hour limit, and then the governor took it down to 275, we've heard from numbers of adults with very complex problems, physical problems. They manage their own care, and they are getting the least expensive, highest quality care that you can get, because they are able to pay their PCA to work with them over a 24-hour period and give them what they need, which is really intermittent care over 24 hours, and that means they don't have to go into staffed settings. So we urge we find a way to preserve that for the people that it's really effective for. And with that, I'll stop and not go through the entire list. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And next is Michelle Kimball. And after Ms. Kimball, it's Ethan Roberts. And would you state your names for the for the tape, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michelle Kimball. I am the Senior State Director for AARP here in Minnesota. I'm joined today by one of my key volunteers, Karina Allen. I'm here to tell you that AARP is very concerned about the governor's budget, and in particular, we are most troubled by the impact that these budget cuts could have on the elderly and frail nursing home residents if rate reductions and the repeal of rate equalization prevails, as well as what they could do to those who are able to receive long-term care in their homes and their communities. To protect these critical services, AARP strongly believes that providers should be adequately paid in order to provide good quality health care, especially in long-term care settings, whether it is in a nursing home or it's in the home and community. Home and community-based services in particular have already suffered a rate cut during the last budget cycle, and they simply cannot afford any more. Such reductions, we believe, could end up with individuals having to choose more expensive nursing homes instead of being able to get the care in their home and community. On average, home and community-based services can provide care to three people for the cost of serving one in a nursing home. So proposed cuts in this area could save a dollar now, but will actually wind up costing the state more in the long run. As for nursing home residents, our most frail Minnesotans, they could suffer in two ways under the governor's proposed budget. First, we are very concerned that the rate cut to nursing facilities could lead to a reduction in staffing, which will lead to a reduction in the quality of care. Second, to make up for this rate cut, the governor proposes to force nursing home residents to pay their own way to pay more by repealing Minnesota's longstanding rate equalization law. This repeal would result in a significant cost shift to residents who pay for their own care out of pocket. In fact, by 2014, nursing homes would be able to charge private pay residents anything they wanted and use it however they wanted without any guarantee that quality would actually improve. Not only would such a shift cost individuals thousands of dollars more, but it could also cost the state more. Increasing the daily rate for private pay residents means they spend down faster and become eligible for medical assistance sooner. Now, we know that the governor's proposed rate equalization repeal has come in budget neutral. However, in 2006, a fiscal note completed in March of 2006 to address House File 2826 actually estimated that by 2009, repealing rate equalization would actually cost the state $9.1 million. We're not sure what changed between then and now, but we have very serious concerns, and we urge you to look into that. That particular note actually assumed that the rate increase would only be 5%. And while pro-repeal advocates actually see this as a way to make up for proposed budget cuts, repeal, in fact, does little to ensure fiscal stability, nor does it address the budget issues facing facilities that have more than a majority of MA residents. Opponents will tell you that we're only one of two states with rate equalization. No one else does it, so why should we? We should maintain rate equalization because it works. We have some of the best quality in the country. Why should we lower ourselves to the standards of other states? We have always been a leader. They should bring themselves up to our standards. AARP urges you to reject repeal of rate equalization and of the proposed budget cuts to long-term care providers who are, in fact, already struggling, and instead find a balanced approach to the budget that allows us, at a minimum, to maintain the current rate that we have. And instead, turn our attention to solving the bigger, more systemic problems that exist in our long-term care system, or rather, the lack of a system, by coming together in a bipartisan way to address long-term care reform. At this time, I would actually like to turn it over to one of my key volunteers, Karina Allen, who knows what it was like here in Minnesota before the rate equalization law and what has happened here since and why it's been good for Minnesota.
The equalization law was one of the many laws that improved nursing home care in Minnesota. It's my understanding that Minnesota and North Dakota now have the highest percentage of good nursing homes in the country. In my second career as a social worker at a clinic out of Hennepin County Medical Center, and later as a part-time social worker in a nursing home, led me to want to help make changes in long-term care. The reasons for passing the equalization law, as I said, was one of the many laws that we went into, including home health. We didn't want a two-tiered health care system. It is difficult to get equally good health care for both groups when one group pays more. Before equalization, most of the good homes had two lists, and I'm familiar with it. If one were a medical assistant patient, most good homes did not have a bed. If one had money, there was a bed available immediately. Many medical assistant patients are people from the upper and middle classes that have run out of money paying for their health care. It is hard for them and very cruel of us to then force them to have to adjust to poor care. After the equalization law, the poor care homes seemed to disappear, and the good homes multiplied because they were paid as much for taking care of medical assistance patients as private pay. A study done a few years ago comparing Minnesota rates with Wisconsin rates shows Wisconsin, which doesn't have equalization, had rates for private pay patients 40% higher than what Wisconsin paid for medical assistance patients. That will rush people into medical assistance sooner. Let's not kill more of the laws that have made our nursing homes so good. We'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for listening to us. I also want to thank some of the people around the table that I notice have worked so hard in the past on some of these things, not always in the legislature, but outside, too. And thank you, Representative Punsley. You've done your share.
Oh, thank you. And Representative Hosh, you had a comment.
I just wanted to make a comment because I'm sure equalization is going to be a matter of debate, and I don't want to debate the merits for or against equalization, but the very question was asked the department, why doesn't this have a cost? Because we would assume there'd be a faster MA spend down, and the department said there was no cost because it was phased out over 4 years. And it's interesting to know that, you know, just a matter of 3 or 4 years ago, a fiscal note was done. And that's the frustrating part, is that it seems like the rules change depending on the proposal and who makes the proposal. And hopefully that's a larger issue this legislature can take up, is how we fiscal note things, because we need to have correct and accurate information when we make decisions that are so impactful on our delivery system and individuals.
Well, perhaps I could give you an example. I have a brother-in-law that was an internist and specialized in cardiology. He taught in the medical school over at the university and had a large private practice. He came down with Alzheimer's at the time. One of his students, who works very actively with Alzheimer's disease, said there is a medication, but it's not available in the United States. So they sent to Switzerland for this medication, which is very familiar now, the one that's used most often. It helped. It helped for a while. It was very costly. And this, now, I mean, it isn't going to be too long he's going to be on medical assistance, because he's been in a nursing home for quite a few years over in Wisconsin. That's what we're talking about. It happens, and it happens quickly when you have to pay all of it yourself. People, if you go on medical assistance, then they're going to have to pay for the drugs, the transportation to a doctor's office. They're added costs that private pay people, if you can drag it out longer for them, that comes out of their own pocket.
Any further questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And since we have a quorum, I'll call the meeting to order.
Thank you.
Next it's Ethan Roberts. There he is. And Pat Rowan, I guess, is there. And after these two, it's Ann Bumstead. Bumstead.
Instead of her, we're having these
three. Okay, we're having three other people from AFSCME Council 5 and Council 65. So, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you so much, Chairman Huntley. Members of the committee, my name is Ethan Roberts, and I am the director of the Twin Cities Jewish Community Government Affairs Program at the JCRC of Minnesota and the Dakotas. You actually do have a copy of my prepared testimony. It's the blue and white letterhead. In my capacity as government affairs director, I represent the Jewish social service providers of the Twin Cities. These nonprofits, which provide a continuum of services ranging from early childhood education to hospice and Meals on Wheels, rely upon a combination of private philanthropy as well as over $20 million in annual federal, state, and local government funding to serve thousands of vulnerable Jewish and non-Jewish Minnesotans each year. In total, these agencies employ, and this is going to be an important point in my comments today, we employ well over 1,000 Minnesotans from all backgrounds and include some of our state's largest and oldest nonprofits, including two agencies which are over 100 years old. While there are many aspects of Governor Plenty's proposed human services budget that deeply concern us, time constraints allow me to only address the governor's proposed 2.5% medical assistance cut to long-term care providers. Notably, this cut represents a $37 million reduction to a sector that supports over 112,000 jobs across Minnesota and is responsible for $6.7 billion in annual economic activity. As this distinguished committee is well aware, these cuts include reductions not just to Minnesota's nursing homes, but as was discussed earlier, to elderly waiver-funded services such as Meals on Wheels, 24-hour customized living, respite care, transportation, the list goes on. And all of these services enable our seniors to remain independent in their own homes. And as was also noted earlier, it's EW services which have already sustained in this biennium a 2.58% cut. Notwithstanding the fact that these services save annually Minnesotan taxpayers $31,200 per person because of the avoidance of more costly nursing home care. So I ask, are these services not the kind of reform that we are always talking about in this committee and at the legislature? And if so, what sense does it make to eviscerate the budgets for the very reforms that are already leading to the choices Minnesotans want and the savings that Minnesota needs? Now, while the negative aspect impact of Governor Plenty's budget cuts on the quality of care for our most vulnerable seniors is very real and absolutely demands your attention, the impact these cuts will already have in Minnesota's already weak economy are also important. For example, the long-term care imperative estimates that the proposed cuts to older adult services will result in over 500 lost jobs in Minnesotans. Within just the agencies I represent, we're bracing for an annual loss of $350,000 and the layoff of 20 employees. Now, each of these employees who are laid off, or if they are fortunate, merely will have their benefits and wages cut, they are as much a part of the Minnesota economy as anyone else. Like all of us, they pay taxes, they shop at our stores, and they proudly support their families. Tightening Minnesota's proverbial belt by punishing these dedicated employees who care for our spouses, our parents, our grandparents, when we as family caregivers can no longer do it all on our own, is not going to do one thing to improve Minnesota's high unemployment and underemployment rates. In fact, it will only make it worse. Put another way, it is these proposed spending cuts that are the real job killers. Now, we realize the decisions that confront the legislature and the governor are not easy. But despite the challenge of a $1.2 billion deficit, you still have the power to choose. For example, you can choose to shelter 40% of the state's budget, K-12 education spending, at the expense of the elderly, the sick, and the poor. And as a side, I say that as somebody who's the father, who's the son of a public school teacher, the husband of a public school teacher, and someone who intends to putting my children through public school until college. So I don't. It's not with any glee that I say we need to look at 40% of the budget. It's just a reality. Additionally, you can hold fast to ideology and choose to address this budget deficit with cuts and one-time funds and shifts and hopefully the FMAP money. Or you can combine these difficult cuts with new sustainable sources of revenue that will allow us to retain the very infrastructure that make Minnesota an exceptional place to grow up, raise a family, and retire with dignity. Finally, there has been already some discussion about Minnesota's radicalization law, which I agree, I think, comes from excellent intentions. But I am afraid, and my nursing homes are afraid, that the sinking ship, which is our state's skilled nursing facilities, is going to drown Medicaid, medical assistance, and private pay residents alike. As it now stands, and this is worth noting since I think North Dakota may have been mentioned earlier, the medical assistance reimbursement rate for skilled nursing care falls below the actual cost of care, and this is just on average in Minnesota, it's actually worse than my providers, by more than $20 per resident per day. By contrast, it's a 14-cent differential in North Dakota. For this reason, if there are going to be cuts to daily medical assistance reimbursement rate, and I really hope that obviously there aren't, we respectfully request that you follow Governor Plenty's lead and allow Minnesota's skilled nursing facilities to raise the revenue they need to safely operate. If you do so, I can promise you that we will do everything that we've always done to assure that all of our residents continue to receive the same exceptional care that they've always received. Chairman Huntley and members of his committee, Thank you, as always, for soliciting our testimony and carefully listening to our perspective. It is truly greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Pat Rowan. I'm the executive director of Metro Meals on Wheels. Metro Meals on Wheels is an association of 40 Meals on Wheels providers in the Twin Cities area. Member programs deliver meals to over 4,000 clients each day and utilizing the generosity of over 14,000 volunteers each year. We leverage public dollars with corporate, volunteer, individual, and community support to ensure that seniors and people living with disabilities remain living healthy and independently in their own homes. We not only provide a nutritious meal, but the daily check-in provided by Meals on Wheels volunteers gives the client and their families the peace of mind that somebody is checking in on them. The demand for home-delivered meals is increasing at the same time the cost to provide the services continues to rise. We are at the cusp of the age wave, and Meals on Wheels is on the front line. Programs have an aging volunteer force, many of whom will be clients themselves soon. By 2050, there will be twice as many people over the age of 65 as there is today. And in the same time, it's projected that there will be a 173% increase in the number of people over the age of 85. This new generation of seniors will be more diverse and require a greater variety of services and choice. These factors will add to the pressure to organizations like Meals on Wheels that have to provide services to the elderly. This is the time to invest in infrastructure and not cut support for programs that are cost-effective and save the state critical funds. The governor's proposed budget may save a few dollars today, but they will leave the state reeling in the future. Metro Meals on Wheels, with our program partners, is working to diversify funding sources, establish new delivery and administrative models, increase and diversify our volunteer base, and collaborate with other services to be more effective, efficient, and sustainable. Metro Meals on Wheels supports a balanced approach to meeting the demands of the current budget deficit. Cuts that focus primarily on services to the elderly, the sick, and the poor will cost the state in the long run. Other aspects of state funding need to help shoulder the burden, and revenue generation must be part of the equation. So thank you for having us here today, and happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Don't say anything. Thank you for your testimony. And next we have Sharon Brussel. I'm not sure of that one. Pam Tate and Michael McCallop. And I see Ms. Okramovich.
Oh, Representative Huntley, you're getting so good.
coming up with them.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jane Okramovich. I need to correct the spelling that's on the agenda for today, but I think you'll all understand why it often is misspelled. I am a volunteer with the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota chapter, and I'm also the president of Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition. What you see with you today are three workers, part of this coalition. And this coalition is made up, as I say, of senior advocates such as AARP, the Elder Care Rights Alliance, the Alzheimer's Association, the Minnesota Adult Day Services people, the Minnesota Nurses Association, and four unions. The representatives here with me today are three members of AFME Council 65, who have, at great cost, tried to get time off from their jobs today to be able to be here to testify for you. Obviously, one of the things that I'm concerned about that I've told you in the past is that I'm also was a consumer of long-term care services for my mother, who was in a nursing home in Ohio for 8 years. And she died of complications of Alzheimer's disease in June of 2005. And for that reason, I am an advocate for vulnerable adults that I'm here to talk to you today. I would like to read for you, even though you have it right in your packets, a very, very powerful testimony that was delivered by a private pay citizen on Tuesday morning, in the Senate committee. And this is Mr. Al McAvee. We are all concerned, the 3 points in particular we're concerned about in the governor's budget are the cuts, as we've said, of 2.5% rate to long-term care in general, as well as the nursing homes, as well as in the community. And the coalition believes that the proposal to repeal rate equalization is unfair, and Mr. McAvey addresses that. In addition, the suspension of the nursing facility rebasing is very disheartening. The letter, as you have it in your folders, from Mr. McAvey. I grew up during the Great Depression. I served in World War II, went to college with the GI Bill, and became a high school business education teacher, working in War Road, Leroy, and Roseville. I also had a locksmith business, and I'm now retired. Alice, my wife of 61 years, worked as a legal secretary, an accountant, and a federal program officer. After many years of retirement, Alice developed dementia. I took care of her in her home for as long as I could, but we finally had to place her in a nursing home where she's lived for 3 years. Over those 3 years, I've gone up to the home to be with Alice every day and often twice per day. I help Alice and the other residents at her table, and I've gotten to know most of the staff. My son and daughter give me a break during the week. I've taken 2 trips out of state during the last few years, but I prefer to be with Alice. Alice and I have served, and we have saved. At the nursing home, we are private payers. We have long-term care insurance, which pays for some of the cost of care. I believe I heard Mr. McAvey say about $2,700 a month. We use our pensions and Social Security to make up the difference. I want to make 3 points about the governor's proposed budget affecting long-term care residents and families. The governor's proposal to repeal rate equalization is unfair and short-sighted. Asking Alice and me to pay more is unfair. It will drain our money faster and push her toward medical assistance. In the long run, this will drive up the state's cost. If we want more people to buy long-term care insurance, this sends the wrong message. The 2.5% rate cut will likely cause staff cuts and worse care in our nursing homes and others across the state. Nursing homes may become less safe, more falls, and unnecessary deaths may occur. As much as I love to be with Alice, I can't do it all alone. Please keep rate equalization in place and oppose the cuts to nursing homes. I'd like to reiterate his point there about the long-term care insurance. I was fortunate enough to have taken mine out 2 years before I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And remember, once you're diagnosed with a condition, you no longer are going to be able to buy any long-term care insurance. In my mother's situation, a nursing home in Ohio, there was discrimination. She was on medical assistance. On her third hospitalization, because she would have been discharged without qualifying for Medicare rates, the home suddenly had no beds available for her. Fortunately, I have a brother who is a very strong advocate. He appeared and said, "You have empty beds. You will find her one," after she'd been in that home for 5 years. I thank you, and now I'll turn it over to our workers.
State your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Brussel. I've worked at Cedar View Care Center for 27 years. I would like to tell you about my last 2 shifts. Because we were short, the afternoon shift worked until 2 a.m. Then I came in at 2 a.m. and was scheduled to work until 2 p.m. On the night shift, there are 2 aides for 64 residents. If an aide goes on break, that means 1 aide for 64 residents. If someone needs to be lifted out of bed, 2 people are supposed to lift. Of course, if there is only 1 aide working, the person has to wait. They may try to get out of bed, or they may urinate in their bed. When a person has to go to the bathroom, they have to go now, not later. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pam Tate. I have been a CNA, Certified Nursing Assistant, for the last 32 years at Cedar View Care Center. I am here to tell you that our elderly cannot afford any more cuts to long-term care. Further cuts to long-term care will result in a further reduction in quality of life. I currently care for some of the World War II generation and the Great Depression. I have worked with 4 great aunts of mine and have seen my grandma go through the nursing home. Luckily, at that time, we did have more care before the last cuts 2 years ago. For example, there was a time when residents were able to bathe daily. Now, due to the cuts, staffing has been reduced to the point that you don't use soap and water in the a.m. before dressing the residents. There are days they are not taken to the bathroom when gotten up, just not enough time before breakfast. So they receive one bath a week in a tub, unless ordered by doctor, the need of two per week. And that there again is depending if we're full staffed that day. My husband is a factory worker. He's worked there for 20 years. He makes more money than I taking care of hardworking human beings who are all part of our country's history. How are we treating them now? Thank you for letting me share my concerns.
My name is Mike McAuliffe. I work as a TMA at...
Weren't you here last year?
Yes, sir. Thank you for remembering. I work at North Country Health Services, Nielsen Place up in Bemidji, Minnesota. I'm a TMA. I'm a PCA. I'm a housekeeper. I'm an activity aide, a therapy aide. The latest consultant said they had to go to Ohio to find a facility with aides with as many job descriptions as I have. The boss is looking for a reason to cut my pay. I'm a registered nursing assistant. I also train nursing assistants. Last year our nursing home was looking at a $1.5 million deficit. We were able to bring that deficit down to $100,000 this year through some reducing of injuries, some hours, overtime. We are now at bare bones staff. Our facility is divided into neighborhoods of 20 residents. On my 3 to 11 shift, we have two aides, an LPN, and a kitchen aide. The kitchen aide makes the dinner and does the dishes. The facility counts the kitchen aide as part of the staff, caring for the residents. If one of the aides calls in sick and we can't find someone to cover, we try to get the aide out of the kitchen and on the floor to work, or we work alone. 3 to 11 aides feed 20 people, and after they eat, we try to get them all to the bathroom and to bed. But if you're alone, it's one aide to do this for 20 people. I understand all nursing home residents are at risk of falls. That's why they're admitted. And in the way to go to the bathroom, some residents will try to go alone. If they have a fall alarm, it may go off. But if two aides are one aid and a kitchen aid may be somewhere else caring for another resident whose alarm is going off in time, then the resident falls. I can hear it, but I can't leave the resident that I'm with. On the 11 to 7 shift, there's one aid for two neighborhoods of 20 residents. That's a total of 40 residents, an LPN and one aid. The LPN can help some, but they can't. But they don't have time to help the aide and get their med pass done also. If you further cuts to our facilities, mm-hmm. What should we cut? We're bare bones staff as it is. As I said, we are already bare bones. Should we go to one aide for 20 people on the 3 to 11 shift, one person to feed, toilet, and put the residents to bed. One aide to transfer all 20 people into their bed at night. Even now, I am being asked to put two attends on the residents on final bed check. That means they sit in their own urine until the next bed check. The reason they want me to double line it is so they can postpone the bed check. because I can't get there on time. I know your time is valuable, and I thank you for listening today.
Thank you. Questions?
I do.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Something you know a lot about.
Well, I certainly do. And thank you all for coming and testifying today. And I understand they also had a car accident on the way up here and still came to testify. So thank you so much because I know how much this means to you. And I feel so grateful that you're in the fight with us. And I just want to, you know, also, you know, talk about the bed check when you're doubling. And that we just take 10, 20 steps backwards. It's just that one piece. I remember years ago, probably 30 years ago, when we were doing that, and this was before the invention of ATEMS, when we used draw sheets for diapers. And, you know, I thought we had come a long way, and we really have come a long way, Mr. Chairman and members, but this takes us way back down the hill.
We are considering that.
Mm-hmm. You probably will be doing that. And in the time that I've been up here, I proposed increases of a 7% and then 5%, 3% and 2% bargaining, trying to get those rates up. And now you know why. And certainly those of us with loved ones in the nursing homes and from if any of this heartless proposal is enacted, we will all suffer from these cuts. On the piece of the charging the private pay people, I just wanted to add that a comment about that as well, that those that money should be encumbered for wages and for folks that are doing the work that you're all doing, because I know you're not getting rich doing the work that you're doing. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Other questions, comments? I don't see any, so thank you for coming here, and I hope your car isn't too bad.
Yeah, we'll make it home.
Dr. Burkett from People Inc. Yeah, and after that's the long-term care imperative. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today along with many, many, many other people who have causes that are probably, I mean, as I listen to these causes, my heart opens, and I'm starting to look in my pocketbook to see if I can find any money. So here's another one, and that's our case, and this is my friend Rick Stein. Rick Stein lived outdoors here by the Capitol not too many years ago. He was out here for several winters, and he's a graduate of our program now. So he's going to talk after I talk. 14 years ago, as new executive director of People Incorporated, I went to our community support program in Minneapolis to find out what we were doing to help people with mental illness, and I noticed two lines in the drop-in center. And I thought the lines maybe were to wait for to go bowling or there was a pool tournament going on, but the program director told me one of the lines was to wait to use the washing machine, and the other line was to wait waiting to use the shower. So these were people who lived outside, people with mental illness, and I had been a psychologist for my whole life, and I didn't know that people with mental illness lived outside. People with developmental disabilities don't live outside. People with other disabilities don't live outside, but I soon found out, and while the studies confirm, that 3/4 of the folks who live outside self-identify as having mental illness, and so we began sending a crew with no county or state support out every morning to get to know the folks, to find out what the deal was, to befriend them, to develop relations with them. And we did this for several years. We delivered socks, we delivered sleeping bags, in the summer we delivered water, We got to know them year after year, and then we came up with this idea that we, in partnership with the University of Minnesota Department of Psychiatry, would develop the first two safe havens in the Midwest to bring people with mental illness who lived outside inside and give them intensive 24/7 support for a series of just a few months, so that then we could move them on and they'd never have to live outside again. And we were successful in starting this program up. You guys, I've come to testify before more than once. In 2007, you put us in the base. I came and brought, I think I brought Rick, actually, in 2007. You put us in the base. And then last year, the governor was going to eliminate us, but thanks to you, he did not. This year, he's proposing eliminating this service again. And as you can see from your white paper, this is very cost-effective program. This is a program, a survey was done that says that the average person who lives outside costs the taxpayers $40,000 a year. People who stay in our program, on the average, go through it and complete it in 120 days at $7,000. Then we're able to keep them in independent living permanently. And if you look at our statistics, 95% of the people we've placed are still in independent living in the last 30 months. And that's 150 people. And that's why you don't see as many homeless camps around here as you used to. And so I'm very proud of that. That's the linchpin of our services to people with homelessness. If we lose these two houses, which the governor is recommending defunding, then our outreach teams won't have any place to take people to anymore. We'll be back to where we were 10 years ago. They can bring them socks, they can bring them water, but they can't do anything else. So I plead with you to seriously think about this. I know you seriously think about this already, but to help maintain this, do what you can to maintain this service. There's a letter in our packet from Dr. Vucetic. This is a collaboration between the University of Minnesota Department of Psychiatry and People Incorporated. And now I'm going to turn it over to Rick Stein, one of the graduates of our programs, and I'm going to pass around the Rick is a graduate, and he now works outside as a volunteer with homeless people. And he's taken these pictures of homeless camps around here, so I'm going to pass them around. Rick?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name's Rick Stein. I was homeless for a number of years. I first got introduced with People Inc. through a food program with the Salvation Army, and over time developed a rapport with their outreach workers, and eventually I was able to get inside with the help of their outreach worker. It's a great program. When I first got in, I discovered that I had hypertension, stage 2 high blood pressure, and that sent off a whole bunch of other things. I've got a whole list of medical problems: COPD, collapsed lung, slip disc, on and on and on. Take about 23 different medications a day now. I can't really say enough about the program. I'm one of those rare cases that kind of stayed a little bit longer than the 120 days because of my medical stuff. We had to keep getting evaluations and stuff. But when you get in there, they have a nurse that comes by once a week that educates you on your medication, your illness, and that. And it's a very beneficial program. Plus, you have Dr. Vucetic that comes by, what's that, every Tuesday, I believe? Yeah. And he sees the clients in the house and that, and does a checkup on them. I'm planning on going back to school pretty soon, hopefully this summer, because everything that I've been trained in the past, I can't do anymore because it involves lifting. I used to be a CNA for 10 years. I've been a manager for a maintenance company. I can't lift anymore because my back. I got a 10-pound weightlift restriction. But it's a great program. It's gotten a lot of people off the streets, and if it gets eliminated, it's just going to throw you know, a lot of people that are depending on the program to get in, you know, they're going to be back out there on the streets and that, and it'd be a big step backwards. It saves the city and county a lot of money. I can't stress that. You know, from, I don't drink anymore. It's been 13 years for me for drinking. It's going on 6 years for narcotics. But what I can say is the certain amount that do drink and have mental illness problems, when they get them off the street, that prevents them from going into detox and that, which is very expensive per day. Hospital stays, jail, you know, once they've got their own housing, you know, a lot of that stuff gets cut out. I also volunteer now with their program. It's called Project Recovery. And we go out to the camps, and that's where I got these photos that Mr. Burkett had passed around. And, you know, we've got a mixed group of people. Some of them are vets. Some are just got serious mental illness problems. So we bring them socks and stuff and try and get them back into society and get them productive again. I've got severe depression, and so we're trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. but that's all I really got to say. And good luck.
Well, thank you. And Representative Bunn, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Thank you again to both of you for coming in this year. And the question I had was, of the number of the participants that you've had through the program so far, how many of them, in the course of your working with them, have you been able to identify as eligible for SSI and move them to that?
Well, it's a long process, as you know. Most of these people that we take in aren't even on JMC. They've never heard of JMC. So first we have to, assuming JMC sticks around, right? First we have to work with them to get them on JMC. Then we have to get them evaluated for Social Security disability. Are you familiar with it's a laborious process, but we have now, we've gotten several dozen on medical assistance certified as disabled, and it's one of our primary. I mean, when you think when we bring them in, if we're going to sustain them in the community, we don't have the money. We've got to get them on Social Security disability, but it takes 1 to 3 years. So the people that we've been working with just a year, they're not on it yet. We've got them on JMC by now, and maybe in the next year we're going to get them on certified as disabled and get them on medical assistance. But we don't give up, because over the course of their lives, they're disabled, and that's going to be crucial to them.
Mr. Burkett, doesn't the state get reimbursed for what we spent on them if they get on SSI?
Yeah, but none of these people get on. Oh, you mean in retrospect?
Yeah, retrospect.
No, they never have. That would be wonderful if there were some legislation that...
I think they do, actually.
Yeah. Oh. Who gets we don't get reimbursed.
No, you don't. The state gets reimbursed for
the state
GAMC.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, well, okay. Great. Glad to hear it. Then there shouldn't be an issue, right?
Okay, any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really wondered, what happens to that money? Where does it go? It doesn't go back into our budget, does it? I mean, when we get reimbursed?
It shows up as just the end of the general fund. Other questions? Okay, well, thank you for your testimony, and thanks for coming down and your good work.
Very welcome.
Long-term care imperative, and then Carrie is coming up. She's next on the list, but you're coming up together.
Mr. Chair, we try to be coordinated so we won't take up too much of your time. Mr. Chair, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'm here with my colleague, Toby Pearson, who I'll allow introduce himself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. We are testifying on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. First, it should come as no surprise that we do, in fact, oppose the governor's proposed cuts to older adult services. We oppose these cuts because of the adverse economic impact of the cuts. I believe you have in your folders one of these sheets that demonstrates a couple of the statistics I'll just run through real quickly. Investments in long-term care strengthen our economy and they protect our seniors. You've heard previously about the stories regarding seniors and the need for their protection and the investment. Long-term care supports 112,600 jobs in the state of Minnesota. Long-term care is responsible for a total of $6.7 billion worth of economic contribution to the state of Minnesota. In short, long-term care in many communities, those providers are a vital economic engine and one of the largest employers in rural Minnesota communities.
Mr. Chair, we'll be tag-teaming a little bit, bear with us here a little bit. I'd like to focus a little bit on the governor's proposed rate cut to the elderly waiver program and how that will impact home and community-based services to the elderly. Then I'll turn it back over to Mr. Pearson to talk more specifically about the care center cuts. Before we talk about the cuts, though, just a little bit of common grounding here. Minnesota has a tradition that we should be proud of, that we have transitioned and tried to rebalance the continuum of long-term care serving seniors more frequently in home and community-based settings. Minnesota has been nation-leading in this transition. And in fact, we are now serving more seniors in home and community-based settings than we are in care centers. And that's something that we should be very proud of. That transition was primarily, that policy decision was made for basically two primary reasons. First, it's what our seniors want. Seniors want to live in their communities and in their homes for as long as possible, and the imperative supports that vision. We've put out documents before and articulated our vision in this way, that we want to provide options in every Minnesota community so that seniors can receive the care that they need in a place that they call home. The second reason for that transition is that it's cost effective. One of the handouts that you've received from us today that has the imperative logo and it has the title Elderly Waiver demonstrates the cost effectiveness, and I think it has been articulated before. But the cost to serve a client through the Elderly Waiver program versus that same client in a care center, the Elderly Waiver program is nearly $2,600 a month less expensive than providing services in a care center. So relevant to this budget discussion today, I hope that you keep that in mind. Unfortunately, the governor's proposed cuts of 2.5% to the Elderly Waiver program puts that vision in danger. The cuts proposed by the governor would be in addition to the cuts imposed last year of 2.58% to the Elderly Waiver program. And if this proposal were to take effect. In addition, over the last year or so, there have been a number of other actions that are articulated in bullet points in your handout that have negatively impacted provider rates in this area. Quite simply, it's piling on cut after cut, and it's becoming very difficult for providers to meet the needs of the clients on the Elderly Waiver program and to cover their costs. These cuts will be borne most significantly on the backs of caregivers and seniors and really does jeopardize that policy decision that we've made to transition to home and community-based services. And so we are opposed to that proposed cut.
We also asked what would happen in the nursing home setting. What does happen is because 76 cents out of every dollar goes directly to wages and benefits, out of every dollar goes directly to wages and benefits, our survey results was that the last time we went through a cut or a 0% rate increase in revenue decreases in 2004 and 5, 59% of people had to do things such as freeze staff wages. Other things that went through, reduced health care benefits, reducing staff wages, reducing retirement benefits, eliminating merit increases, reducing staff hours. None of these things do we like to see happen in our settings. You've heard previously from some of the testifiers the difficulty of the workers in these settings. So your cuts that occur in nursing home settings go directly to the and directly impact those workers. Another thing that we just need to remind you of is that the lack of economic investment has led to 56 nursing facility closures since 2000. 34% of Minnesota's counties have experienced at least one closure. Basically, our message is this. Cuts to older adult services will harm the economy in many communities. Cuts to older adult services will harm individuals in many communities. Cuts by themselves are not a solution.
And lastly, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, while we've spent a lot of time criticizing the governor's proposed cuts, we do want to leave you with a message of reform. The long-term care imperative has put out a document that you should have received probably the first week of session called Changes Imperative. It also can be found, I think, on both either Aging Services of Minnesota website or Care Providers website, and be happy to get that for you. But we've laid out a vision of how we can transform the financing and delivery of long-term care here in Minnesota. It calls for a multi-prong approach, and just very briefly, that multi-prong approach calls for increased public investment in our older adult services across the spectrum, enhancing private and encouraging more personal responsibility for individuals to plan for and save for their long-term care needs, and an administrative alignment to refocus and to better bring aligned the administrative functions, state's administrative functions, as it relates to older adult services policy. I'm going to pause here and say that under this particular plan, there's one portion of the governor's proposal that is aligned with this proposal, and that is the governor's proposal to repeal rate equalization. Now, I know you've heard a lot of testimony on rate equalization already today, and I know that this is not a hearing quite simply only on that proposal, but we do want to say for the record the imperative supports the governor's proposal to repeal rate equalization. There are lots of arguments on both sides of the issue, and we would like very much to speak to every one of you to hear your questions and concerns and to have that open-minded debate. The rate equalization law, quite simply, was passed in the late 1970s based on a covenant with the state that the state would keep up the medical assistance rates with the cost of care. Right now, and if you can see in your handouts right now, that rate falls about $20 per resident per day less than the cost of care. If we are looking at rate cuts, that also means that the private pay rates would be reduced in this legislative session. And so we are asking to take close examination of that policy. We believe that current law should reflect the current usage of care centers. A lot has changed since the 1970s. Anti-discrimination laws have changed, and the ways we use care centers do minimize the risk of faster spend down here in Minnesota. So we'd like to very much continue that conversation and just put those comments on the record for that particular issue today.
Thank you. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. I don't know if you will know the answer to this or not, but do we have information as to the number of beds that are used for the elderly versus people who are there rehabbing? I know as a little girl, when I'd go to the nursing home, it was to visit a grandmother. Recently, it's to visit friends who are status post knee replacements.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, that's a good question. We can check with our who we affectionately call our data guys, to see if we can get you specific numbers. But we would say that your observation anecdotally is correct, that the average length of stay, or excuse me, the median length of stay in a care center has shifted dramatically, and now it's just 28 days. And you'll see that from your handout. That's due largely because we've changed the way we use care centers to more of a rehab function. And obviously, that rehab function may be paid with a different payer mix, Medicare primarily, and also the changes that risk of spend down. So we will try to get you that information.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next we have Mark Peterson from Lutheran Social Services. He will probably be the last.
Well, I'll try and make my time worth your while. Good afternoon, Chairman Huntley, members of the committee. I'm here. I'm going to change what I was going to say because I think there's one thing you haven't heard yet today, believe it or not. I'm here on behalf of the 100,000 people that LSS of Minnesota is privileged to serve each year. I'm here specifically to talk about the 1,200 persons with developmental disabilities that we serve year in and year out. I want to make one quick point about the rate cut that was that's proposed in the governor's budget. If the governor's proposal were to be adopted, that would mean that over the past 7 years, our total cumulative rate increase over that seven-year period would be 2.5%. So all of the stories that you've heard earlier about the effect of rate cuts are stories that we can echo in our own experience. Last September, I was in Leroy. One of the lady from the Alzheimer's Association referenced her growing up in Leroy. I like Leroy. 28 years ago, we built an ICFMR down there in Leroy for 16 people. The facility wore out over that period of time. We were fortunate in finding a philanthropist to come forward to provide us the capital that we needed to build two new group homes, one in Leroy, the other in Adams. Last September, we dedicated those two facilities. We filled the American Legion Hall in Leroy with local folks who were proud as punch about how that community embraced this population. The local Catholic priest invoked God's blessings on this Lutheran building. We liked that. But as much as anything, I think the message that happened that day was it was a celebration of how this community embraces people with developmental disabilities. And so as we think about the challenges we have in front of us, I believe that the people of Minnesota have big hearts and want to assure that all the people that are vulnerable that we need to serve have a genuine opportunity to live not only in safety, but with dignity as well. That's the message from Leroy. And the only other thing that I want to say is there's a person who lives in one of our group homes here in Ramsey County who wrote a letter to Senator Klobuchar. And I want to read that to you, and I'll provide each of you copies of her letter. She writes, "Dear Amy," I don't think she knows her very well, but she's, "Dear Amy, thank you for your hard work. I live with three other ladies, and we look out for each other. Please look out for each other. Please look out for us." From Kristen. And I believe that's all I got to say.
I don't think you could say any more than that. Any questions? Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. And with that, I'm going to adjourn the meeting.